www.org.
Homegrown Community Radio.
For Eugene and Springfield.
Tune us in.
It was great the first time. Okay, so, yeah, okay, I'm talking with Keith McHenry, of one of the original founders of Food Not Bombs. All right, so it's called Food Not Bombs. The only one making bombs that I know is the federal government. So can't the money be better spent than on just blowing up bombs?
Yeah, well, that's the thing that, you know, when I started, I was delivering all this produce to this family that had a housing project in Cambridge and Portland Ave. Across the street, there was like this brand new building. And I've been hearing for months about the complaints of the public housing authority and not fixing stuff. And the people there said, oh, that's where they design nuclear weapons. So I looked into it, and it's where Draper Laboratory was designing the guidance system for intercontinental nuclear missiles. And that, to me, seemed like, wow, what a waste. Also, at that time, Carter was running against Reagan, and it was already, I was very active with the New England War Tax Resisters, and I, of course, gravitated to that, or maybe not, of course, but I was influenced originally by reading On Civil Disobedience by Thoreau, and that's how I became an activist. So it made total sense to be organizing against militarism, and that's why we chose the name Food Not Bombs, because really, but roughly 50 cents of every tax dollar still overtly that we pay in income tax goes to the military, and it's actually probably substantially more than that, if you figure into the you know, all the different aspects, including the black budget, which who knows how big that is, but that's totally connected to military and spying.
Well, and if we're quoting, you know, Orwell said, the war is waged by the ruling group against its own subjects. Isn't this how the ruling group extracts money from the economy, is with war?
Absolutely. And first of all, we spend we trade health, universal health care, housing, education, all the things that could be paid for, even by a fraction of the military budget. But the other thing is the military is the enforcer of this political and economic system. So, for example, if you're in Food Not Bombs, we were originally declared one of America's most hardcore terrorist groups by the military in 1988 is the first we knew of this. And they were saying such because, from their perspective, we were money would be diverted from the military spending towards education, healthcare, and other social services, and that's what made us a political threat, just by the fact that the State Department had a lecture at Tufts University in April of 2009, where they compared Food Not Bombs to Al Qaeda, and claimed that we were much more dangerous because we were actually could impact the funding for the weapons industry. But then we've had huge conflicts. For instance, we've been protesting in Tucson when I lived there against Raytheon because it controlled the city politically at the same time as is manufacturing cruise missiles that were being used against the people of Iraq. So, you know, it's not only robbing us here at home of our resources, but it's used to intimidate the world into compliance. And I think that's one of the aspects of this. And it's beyond just the military attacking other countries, but it's also that technology being used by intelligence agencies here in the U.S. and by police departments.
Well, and so that just occurs to me, certainly almost every major city, certainly every state has a defense contractor. So I wonder, so how much do they really control the state and the cities?
Well, I think they control the states and the cities by, one, you know, threatening to withhold jobs. That's why Bernie Sanders, even when he was running for president of the United States, was supporting the continued funding of the F-35, which is one of the craziest weapon systems in the world, you know, not as far as financially, in that it was the companies building it that determined the amount of F-35s that need to be made, and yet it turned out the military didn't really want it because it was not useful in combat. So that's insanity. And the fact that Bernie Sanders would be running, essentially trying to mimic food, not bombs, you know, money for food, not for bombs, but instead is advocating for the use of the building of the F-35 in his community. That was like really crazy. And I think that just goes to show that he, you know, when questioned about that, they said, well, he, you know, the jobs would just go to some other state, so it would ultimately not mean anything.
Well, so that's where I'm going with this is how much, you know, shouldn't we be pushing the states and the counties and the cities, you know, the mayors have a mayor's council and the governors have a governor's council that they can talk to the federal government. Shouldn't we be, I mean, I believe in pushing against homelessness on all fronts, obviously, but isn't the keystone the federal government that, and we should be pushing the cities and the counties and the states to push the federal government to stop these austerity programs?
Yeah, well, you know, there's a big history in organizing around that. So one of the things that happened was that the, you know, these associations, the National Chief of Police Association, the in California you have the League of Cities, they actually conspire against the public to make sure there is no actual resources diverted to homelessness and hunger unless it goes to them directly and personally. So that's been a big problem. We know when they first were arresting Food Not Bombs in San Francisco that the California Association, California League of Cities Committee for City Attorneys had come up with a whole strategy of how to get rid of Food Not Bombs. So there, we see that in many, many of the policies. For example, you know, there's the medicalization of homelessness, which was developed, I think, even by like right-wing think tanks like Heritage, but was initially adopted by or successfully placed as a policy in the federal government by the Clinton administration, which was to determine that all people that were unhoused had to fit into three categories, either drug addict, alcoholic, or mentally ill. And they didn't have and don't have a category called I can't pay my rent. And so when you go to try to get housing, they ask all these incredibly detailed, horrible questions. One of the ones that is most egregious recently that I overheard was that they ask you if you got prescription medication, if you sold it. Now, what adult needs to be telling the federal government the answer to that? That's insanity. That's and this is for a promise of housing that you will never get. So it's not like it's you got the housing and now you're having to as a privilege of having housing, you know, give up all your rights.
Right, you have to incriminate
for the promise of housing.
You have to incriminate yourself first, then we might give you housing. All right, so if you're just indigent though, you don't qualify for these programs is what you're saying. And the reason I bring up indigent is because isn't this debtor's prison where if you're making it illegal to be indigent and then you're arresting someone to be indigent and now they have to pay fees to get out of jail, isn't that debtor's prison?
It is definitely a debtor's prison. And so, and it's actually been ruled by the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals in the federal district in California in the West Coast, that is cruel and unusual punishment to be ticketing people merely for being outside when there's no other possibility for them to be anywhere else. This is a double-edged sword, though, because now what we're seeing is particularly liberal Democrats across the country are advocating this ideology called obligation to accept shelter. And that, many of us are worried, is similar to like a Japanese internment camp type policy based on you know, that well, it's for your own good. So, for instance, here in Santa Cruz, there is, where I live, they're talking about, you know, they just made a law, which come into effect in July, that essentially you can't be anywhere, like, living within the city. And they're going to have, but, I mean, if you want to live in the city, you have to be one of the lucky people who gets to live in a parking lot between the hours of 8 at night and 8 in the morning. And then you have to pack up all your stuff, put it in a shipping container at this parking lot, do whatever you're doing for the day, and then come back at 8. This at a time when there's empty units in hotels, they're building luxury condos that are probably going to just be ghost condos where no one lives in them. We already see that we have a number of these developments here that are empty already.
Because nobody can afford to live in them.
When they call them affordable housing, this is also part of a strategy that is quite outrageous as well. In the in this one affordable building, that's the first one I've seen actually in years and years of living here. You had to make at least $33,000 a year to qualify for the affordable housing, and then the other thing is when local people who did have jobs but were living on the street tried to get into one of these places, they were told they were already full. The other thing in this particular case, because of the criminalization of homelessness, there is a block to getting housing because I know myself, I've been denied housing repeatedly in Santa Cruz because I have a misdemeanor conviction. And if you have a misdemeanor conviction, you can't get housing because that's one of the ways they can take you off the list of all the many people trying to get housing. Now, the other thing is the housing authority. People here like can be on the list for years. And one of my the main chef today, Sea Otter, he was explaining he got a Section 8 or knew of his girlfriend really got the Section 8 housing at a third of your income. And then it was double. The rent was increased dramatically and they had to move out. It was just not affordable because there's no protections for the people that are placed in this. And this might be why in the county of Santa Cruz, there's a program called Housing Matters, which has a sign across the front that says that they house 100 people a year. They get millions and millions of dollars. In fact, $50 million a year is spent on the shelter program in this town or in this county for what they say is 2,000 people living outside. So, but that does not include the $15 million a year that the police spend within the city limits and so on. So it's in the millions and millions of dollars. And those millions, which we've been calling for to be used for single room occupancy hotel construction to opening up already buildings that are sitting empty, it just goes on a deaf ear. And what this brings up to me is that the people in power don't perceive us as humans, and therefore they can treat us like rodents. And their language at city council and so on, and in his supervisors' meetings, indicates that they do not look at people living outside as humans. And I think that's part of the reason it's okay to have three classifications of medicalization of unhoused people. And I think it's also important for the people in power to promote the ideology that it's personal failure. And sadly, too many unhoused people in the United States do take it like it's personal failure because there is this horrible frustration as you are ending up on the streets. And people internalize that when it's really a political system. But that's that and racism, homophobia, these things things are used to divide. And I think that's why identity politics is valuable from the Democratic Party point of view, because then they can encourage this divide while sounding like they're liberal, when the real issue, you know, those are not issues to not be concerned with, but they are used to avoid talking about the class issues, which also impact all of those same groups of people. And so I think that the entire system is really designed and rigged specifically to maintain power. And but what's concerning is to allow like 40 million families in the United States to face eviction all at once and not provide any kind of organized relief. So, and as an example of that, we have the California had over $100 million for rental assistance, and yet it's paid like less than $2 million out as the evictions are starting to cascade, and people wonder where that money is. But that's where every single program is essentially the same. We have a Housing for Health, about $20 million, and it doesn't. But none of that money is earmarked for building or putting people in housing. It's for collecting information on what unhoused people need.
But that's what I'm getting at.
That $20 million to do that is ridiculous.
But the federal government and their policies have caused the homelessness in the first place. So since they caused it, they should compensate people for their loss, is how we justify that they should be paid for their rent, assisted with their rents. But go back to you said there's a federal mandate that forces the cities to deal with this problem that the Fed has caused in the first place, is what I'm getting at, is how much burden is put on the cities by the federal government. Isn't most of it caused by the federal government? So shouldn't they do something about it? It's a federal problem.
The federal government should definitely do something about it. And the fact that the political system is divided up into cities, counties, and states, and then the Fed, has been used by all of those branches, those levels of government, to pass the buck to the other level. National Conference of Mayors, every few years, homelessness is the big thing, and then the federal money is diverted to the friends of the local government to spend. And so it's all the way along that everybody on the political system, from the city all the way to the federal government, has an angle to benefit themselves directly and personally that is separate from the actual need to make sure everybody has housing. So, like, for instance, there is there could have been laws against the current wave of hedge funds buying up massive amounts of property. So apparently right now, roughly 30% of single family homes are actually owned by hedge funds.
Corporations.
And this by
real estate, investment. Investment funds.
Yeah. And so there'd be efforts to try to change local laws to ban that from happening. But for instance, in our community, there was $750,000 was dumped into a campaign to first stop very minor rent control effort that was here, which affected 5,000 units in the city of 65,000 people. And the other thing was then they used the proceeds from that to get rid of the two city councilors who were trying to seek solutions to homelessness, and then they put in some pro-property speculator city councilors, and now they're just like greenlighting massive luxury condo developments and luxury hotel developments, and refusing to actually even fund barely anything for helping people that live outside. And then, of course, there's always this myth that the people living outside came from somewhere else, and every city says that. But I know for a fact that at least 60%, even according to the last HUD study, are people that are from here that have lived here 10 years or greater, and many of them were born and raised. here. So,
well, so the point is, though, that the money goes to, the money stays in the hand, instead of spreading the money out to a large group of people, the money stays in the hands of the elite. And what Keynes said, what has been proven to work, is you put the money in at the bottom, and that rate, that brings money, that gives money to everyone if they put the money in the bottom. But what you're saying is they keep giving it, they stop the money from getting to these people and keep it, keep control. The elite keeps control of this money. So, but what I'm getting at is, go ahead.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's the case. It's basically the everybody skims the off the money. So, well, here in Santa Cruz, there's a one of the main programs for homeless people is called Housing Matters. They changed their name and got all this fancy publicity. I have no idea how much money they spent on rebranding, but it was clearly a huge effort. I'm sure a corporation sort of sponsored it, but probably grants were given to fund it.
The promotion of it.
Just to make it a cool, slick thing, but it didn't go to homeless people. Then Jeff Bezos gave $2,500,000 to Housing Matters, and then a month later they shut down one of their sober unit, their shelter, and so because they didn't have enough money. But then, of course, if you look into it, then, well, that $2,500,000 went to another program, not to that program. So they have like a whole shell game program. And that's what they tell for the whole 40. Well, really, I got most involved in the actual repression of homeless people when I was in Boston in 1985. But from that first contact with the police about quality of life enforcement and the need to criminalize homeless people till now, there's been this one theme the entire time, which is we want to spend as little money on actually helping unhoused people as possible. And if we can divert the money to our programs where we get salaries and cushy jobs, people on the street call it poverty pimps, then that's what we'll do.
And then they give it to the police.
We don't pay staff. We just are out there with the people, So, and that's, I think, why the authorities, in part, feel so threatened.
Well, and then the money goes to the more policing, too, instead of solving the problem.
Yep,
they just treat the symptoms of a problem. So,
the main thing for the people in power to, they just keep the money amongst themselves and then do lots of public relations stuff. Now, I remember, for example, the nonprofit community is integrated into the political repression of the mm-hmm. state in a number of ways. So I worked
KEPW LP 97.3 FM, Eugene, Peaceworks Independent Community Radio, also streaming online at KEPW.org.
So, well, go to Joe, India Joe's, we have none here, and ask Joe. Yeah, 418, sorry. Okay.
Where I'm going with all this is that, many historians would say that Nazi Germany, the reason we had Nazi Germany was because the elite put the burden of World War I on the middle class. And so are we going to see another Trump coming up here because they continue to put the burden on, and I agree with a classless society. I think everyone should be, there should be a class of people that are just have a little bit of conspicuous consumption and the rest is, and we all have the same amount of money, or the same amount of standard of living. But isn't this how they as they continue to, with these programs, we're going to continually see the decimation of the middle class and another Trump will appear. This is how we get fascism.
Well, yeah, Trump was probably nothing compared to what is happening even currently now and what is likely to continue. So the people in power now, so typically in my lifetime, which is almost 65 years, what I have observed is that the Republicans in power, they push all these really insane ideas. And then the Democrats come into office and they implement all those ideas that everybody was angry about. So that's what we're seeing now under the Biden administration. But I think you're right. What is happening. So, you know, like basically, you know, the middle class is being destroyed, and the policies that Trump couldn't get through are now cascading in spades and across the society. But I do believe that neo-Nazis that are in that kind of whole background, you know, white supremacists, people with all kinds of political agendas, and I think particularly people in power like to promote racism, homophobia, misogyny, and so on, because it divides and conquers the
right. It's the oldest trick in the book: divide and conquer.
And so I think you can see, like, for instance, that you know, it's no surprise that some of the leadership of groups like the Proud Boys or, you know, 3%ers or Oath Keepers and so on turn out to be law enforcement, because there's a definite it's really valuable to divide and conquer. And so that's really you know, there's just as much reason for them to be infiltrating those groups to just watch out for some kind of alleged criminal activity that they actually do care about, which is, I have no idea what that might be, I guess murdering the wrong people, or to facilitate the direction of those white supremacist groups. So we found that to be true in with Funa bombs. We had 4 of our volunteers were killed in Russia during. What we determined, what seemed like was going on, is that the white supremacist groups in Russia are basically the civilian arm of the local security apparatus, and it's something that's been created and developed over a long period of time. And then, and so they were just launched on the local Food Not Bomb chapter under the, in the 4 different cases, under the ideology that the local Food Not Bombs was actually feeding Caucasians, which were people from the Caucasus, that they deemed to be, you know, impure, you know, Russians or whatever. So essentially the security forces are able to hype up that kind of agenda and magnify it to their advantage. And that we see is happening here in the United States. This is like also a common trick that was done in Nazi Germany. So I do think we have some parallels. And I do think that if the people that whoever comes after the Democratic Party and after Biden and so on will be even more, another notch worse, and maybe be what the liberal Democrats are thinking of as a dictator. Even though it's possible too that the people in power will just skip all that, and it'll just be like this kind of corporate power where it's like completely not even, you know, right now we can see the corporations are doing mass censorship. You know, they're building up the whole story to develop a new infrastructure for domestic terrorism, which appears to include people that are against corporate power as one of the categories. Well, in fact, it touches on almost every one of their categories, with the exception of the white supremacist section of their concerns, and that they're using the Capitol event on January 6th as the excuse. And so most Americans really are, including most Trump supporters, are really against racism. But you never get this kind of, you know, this divide and conquer is just super important.
Well, but the point I'm trying to make, though, is if it wasn't for, this is how important groups like Food Not Bombs and mutual aid societies are, is if it wasn't for poverty, these guys would be laughed out of the beer hall. That's where their power comes from, is the increase in poverty. Poverty is what gives them their power.
Yeah, it's one of the best recruiting tools, and that's where we're at this balance here between, if there were no Food Not Bombs, then you're right. A huge percentage of disenfranchised people that are completely pissed off because they've been screwed would join white supremacist movements. And so I think you're exactly right. I think that what's sad is that the organized left is so disorganized that this would be an optimum time for the ideas that Funabombs is promoting to be adopted by much more people. Although I think that one of the issues is that there's very little media, no real studies maybe. It's just kind of invisible. But I believe that there is this potentially as large a much larger number of Americans that are attracted to the ideas of Funabombs. Not that they even know about Funabombs, but the basic concept that money should go to stuff that is needed.
Oh, you mean NPR? You haven't been on NPR?
Media.
NPR hasn't interviewed you lately?
No, we have never it's funny you should say that. We have never been on National Public Radio since the very beginning, with the exception of one or two very small local stories.
Right.
But yeah, no, we are essentially whited out. We've never been on. We were only on CNN on August 22nd of 1988, which is also the day that a memo was written about that day, declaring us a national security threat, an FBI joint. Well, it wasn't Joint Terrorism Task Force at the time, but whatever the FBI itself had we have evidence in FOIA of their concern at that time. We haven't been on.
Of course not the major media.
We're pretty much never on any kind of world media, global media, ever.
So continuing
particularly
on.
No media in the United States. We were a little bit of NPR when I was in jail for feeding people, and when other people were in jail for feeding people in Orlando, Florida. There was one, so that would be a mention. But I've never been interviewed by anybody in NPR other than the local station here one time.
Continuing on, though, for instance, the more and what I see happening is the more corporations oppress people, and the more we have this neoliberalist philosophy in our federal government and in our government that encourages corporate malfeasance. The more that happens, the more people are displaced, the more groups like you are going to be needed. And we have the Anarchist Coalition up here in Eugene that feeds people for free. And like, for instance, I think that these mutual aid societies and places like Food Not Bombs, if we ever had a labor strike, if we ever had a general strike or a countywide strike for labor, this is what we need, is people like Food Not Bombs to get people through the strike.
We've fed a lot of strikes over the years, that's for sure. And we've done so for instance, in the weeks before our original arrest on August 15th of 88, we were providing breakfast at hospitals around the city during a nurses' strike. We provided bulk food and produce and bread and so on, other commodities to striking newspaper workers at the when they were going out on strike against the San Francisco Chronicle. So we've fed a lot of strikes. We also helped organize the many of the kitchens during Occupy, for example. We did a 2-year occupation of Parkins in Sarajevo, supporting a farm workers strike there. We also, not that necessarily this was the best thing, I think Funabombs people have rethought this, but we provided food during the Orange Revolution in Kiev, which now turned out to be was a total US CIA scam. But anyway, so that Funabombs got sucked into doing that. And if you didn't know it was CIA program, it was otherwise an altruistic thing to do. So we do have that history. We also have a history of providing food for people in right now, like we're doing commodity distribution and raw food throughout areas of Myanmar during the military coup. We're busy doing that right now.
So you're worldwide.
We're in over 1,000 cities of the world, and at least 65 countries at this point. You know, then and sometimes there's a mixture between the direct service being just mutual aid and being participating in a protest. For example, there's a lot of social unrest in Beirut, and our Food Nabob chapter there is involved in dealing with that. Our Jerusalem chapter is also in the midst of a struggle there. Tel Aviv Food Nabobs are actually those volunteers. Are the people that started Anarchists Against the Wall, and that they're people that I spent time with in the West Bank. Then we've had like political struggles that we've been participating in Indonesia against lead mining, against destruction of traditional food markets, things like that. So we have a lot, you know, that's. So we have three principles. The food is always free to everyone, rich or poor, drunk or sober.
Liberal or conservative.
Too. Or liberal or conservative or any which old way. And the other thing is that we don't have any leaders. Each group is autonomous and makes decisions, inviting the actual people that rely on the food to have equal access to power within the local chapter, and that we are not a charity, but that we're dedicated to nonviolent direct action. And so those are to change society so no one has to live in the streets or eat at a soup kitchen. So that is how our movement can be global and adapt to things. And so, for instance, when white supremacists, attacked Food Nabobs in St. Petersburg, Russia, they killed one person, Tumur. He was also in a punk band called Sandinista. And then a week later, they came back and set off a time bomb there. And that was because of the diversity of people that were eating with us. And it's quite possible that some of the people involved in the plot had been working, had been eating and depending on the food with us, but were recruited by state security to participate in that attack.
Well, but real quick, how do you procure your food? So you don't have deals with grocery stores and stuff like that. You actually go and you just go to local businesses and get their extra food, right? Or people donate it to you.
Yeah, our food is all through like donations. So, we get farmers markets, produce markets at grocery stores, bakeries, manufacturers of different foods, I recall there was a textured vegetable protein factory near the warehouse where Food Nabobs cooked in Salt Lake City. And so they got those donations, so it's like, it's all kinds of ways like that we get donations. And that makes it possible. There's about 45% of the food that's produced is thrown away. This is actually going to get to be heavier though. It looks like between the droughts and other climate change problems with the general political clampdown that looks to be happening, the switch in the economy to a kind of a digital central bank economy, all the different sort of Orwellian crazy things that are going on will mean that our direct personal relationships with our people giving us the food and that we're working with is going to be more important than ever. So we don't rely on dumpster diving, although in some areas of the world that's what has to happen. But we have long-term personal relationships with people that are in the food industry in local areas that we depend on and work with. And that we think that's partially more sustainable. For instance, Food Not Lawns itself was started by one of the volunteers at the Eugene Food Not Bombs, Heather Flores. So there's these other spin-off ideas like that. And then mutual aid during the pandemic has really grown, which is amazing. And I think that that's here to stay, and I think a lot of these relationships are stronger, and that in a large part is going to be the solution. It's all along in Food Nabobs we've had kind of dual ideas, one pushing back against the state and trying to disrupt their egregious, monstrous activities, and those are the corporations that sponsor the governments, and at the same time, practicing interacting and practicing our non-hierarchical way of organizing and community building to replace the collapsing society. So we actually discussed probably from the very beginning on May 24th, 1980, the eventuality of what we are is starting to see very dramatically now as a result of people in power taking advantage of the pandemic or participating in causing the pandemic or whatever the heck is going on. But you can see that, you know, this crisis now is magnitude much worse than the 2007-2008 housing foreclosure crisis, and that, you know, we're hoping that our street credibility of being out on the streets with the people for all these decades is going to be one way to attract cooperation for both resistance to these new wave of egregious laws and policies, and at the same time make it so that people can survive and flourish and really do well even in the case of an economic collapse that we're all currently trying to survive in.
Well, because you helped start Homes Not Jails. Also, you mentioned the fracas in Florida. Wasn't that over a squat? Don't you guys, wasn't that a squat in Florida that you got arrested at?
Oh, no, actually, the police arrested, it was not a squat. In Florida, we were arrested for feeding hungry people in Fort Lauderdale. We were arrested, I personally was arrested for feeding people in Orlando, Florida.
Is it still illegal to feed people? And, you know, you're vegan, you're vegetarian, right, because it's less likely, then they don't have justification that they had for you feeding people that you might poison somebody. This is vegan foods tend to be, you tend to not have people get sick from vegan food. It doesn't spoil like beef, like meat does.
Yeah, it is easier. It's much less expensive to safely handle vegan food than it is non-vegan food. That is for sure. That is certainly one of the reasons for why we have a policy of you know, around vegan food and vegetarian food. Now, vegetarian, typically, that is usually breads and so on that we might not know the details of their ingredient. But and chapters are kind of fluid with that, I must admit. That's not, you know, there's a lot of kind of more vegetarian than vegan type chapters.
Is it still illegal to feed the homeless?
Yeah, it can be legal. In fact, in California, it's essentially all the Food Not Bombs groups are operating illegally from the state's point of view, because they had made some ordinance, a statewide law that you had to get this certain kind of permit that they said would make it easier. But it actually, the restrictions are such that it would be easy for any county to ultimately use that relatively new law, 2 years old, I think, law to shut down organizations. We actually were approached by the local county here to about this and trying to get us, you know, they said, oh, we're making it easier for you to serve food. But it turns out that it was that in that particular, the California state law, they changed the environmental health regulations that you used to not be able to get a health permit but three times in 90 days. And then their idea, due to complaints, so to speak, from anti-homeless act people, was to make this policy where you could actually get a permit for the whole year every day. But then the requirements were such that anti-homeless vigilantes would be able to shut down your commercial kitchen through pressure, and therefore you lose your right to continue to share food. So we came to an agreement in Oakland at a Food Not Bombs gathering that no chapters would apply for or accept permits from the state of California or any environmental health. Well, I mean, basically we've had the policy that we would not, we first agreed on that in actually October of 1992, that we would never accept or apply for a permit or for permission to serve food, and so we don't. But then there are 75 cities that have specific ordinances that limit the sharing of free food to such an extreme that it might as well be illegal. And the purpose of most of those laws, they allow you to serve someplace on the very edge of the city, typically under a freeway or out in a field somewhere, and that becomes the only legal place where you can serve food. So that's pretty common as well. As a law, that would be, like I say, in roughly 70 cities. Now, there's been an attempt. I don't know if this law still exists, but the only state to completely outlaw basically feeding people outside, of all things, was Hawaii. I don't know if it's still the case. And that was a direct law against feeding people outside, unlike a more indirect law like the one here in California. And then the only state that 100% made it legal to have unrestricted sharing of free food with the homeless is the state of Connecticut. And that was as a result of a legal struggle with Middletown, Connecticut Food Not Bombs and the local authorities there. And so in the United States, that's generally the case. There were a lot of harassment and arrests of Food Not Bombs around the pandemic in other countries for violating, like, for instance, in Minsk, we were arrested. We were arrested in Russia. So there's been some of that with threats of arrest in Malaysia. And that's because of using emergency measures of the COVID pandemic.
All right. I don't want to take up too much of your time, but I want to get into covert squatting, though. What is covert squatting?
Okay. So now, there is a renewed National Union of the Homeless. Back in the 90s, the National Union of the Homeless, when it first was starting to organize, largely kind of inspired by Kensington Welfare Rights in Philadelphia, and then Rod Coronado and them at the Tompkins Square Park. There became a Housing Now actions on Thanksgiving. And in 1992, we participated in that by first showing in solidarity. It was basically Food Not Bombs and the Tenants Union, San Francisco Tenants Union with Ted Gullickson. And we showed videos on European squatting at this community center in the Tenderloin, the poorest neighborhood in the central part of San Francisco. And so then because we advertised that event, somebody came with a key to a XXX movie theater that was being up for sale like a block away, and the realtor didn't want to come to town, so they just gave the key to that person. And then across the street from where the mayor was going to come and cut turkey at the do his photo op at Glide Memorial Church, there was a empty hotel that was being converted into a luxury hotel, in violation of local city law. And so what we did was we snuck into that building, the hotel, and moved families into the other building we had keys for. And then when the mayor came, we hung banners outside the windows. They'd removed all the glass from in the restoration. And one of them was Homes Not Jails. And so we adopted that as a name. And there's a book written called No Trespassing that talks about the founding, I think it's even chapter one, about the beginnings of Homes Not Jails. And so what we would do is we would go around, in those days, there was the savings and loan crisis that was the issue. Today it would be these hedge funds and vulture capitalists owning properties that would be the targets. And so what we would do is go to the tax office, because it's before the internet, and find out who owned the buildings. Usually, because of the savings and loan crisis, there'd be 8 or 9, 10, maybe even 20 mortgage companies that broke up the mortgages. And so we would therefore verify it wasn't like a family that just couldn't pay, that it was actually owned by a corporation. So then we would go and we would put locks on each of these buildings. And we had locks on 400 buildings, empty buildings in San Francisco, and a wall of all the keys with their addresses. And then we would go to the Food Not Bombs meal, which in those days we were doing twice a day. We would talk to people that we knew and ask if they would like to get a place to live. And so we would have already been working on the property. We would show up at 9, typically at 9 in the morning, and work through in the day rather than doing it at night. And then we would then move the family in, give them a lease, and you know, giving them permission to at least go get more utilities and things like that. We, of course, turn on the water. We figure out the safety of that. And then, you know, if, some of the people with more experience with electricians would turn on the power for the house. And according to the book, No Trespassing, we had people in roughly 100 houses in different degrees. You know, sometimes people would be in a house for a week, sometimes one day, sometimes for months at a time. And then we, to get them started, we'd make sure food was delivered. People would stay it, kind of in it, go in and out, make it look like it was a, you know, like it was a, just a normal situation where people are renting. And, but then we would do action ones where we knew we couldn't keep the building, that it was just not appropriate to live in, and we'd take over those buildings. And so then I actually was in Eugene on the unfree, on the rent as theft tour, and where I broadcast my I did a cooking demonstration that also doubled as the history of Food Not Bombs and encouraged people to make their own pirate radio station and to organize their own local homestead sales campaign. And so that's what I went to about 60 cities in North America doing that, and trying to encourage squatting movement.
Well, because there's, even in San Francisco, there's empty abandoned buildings. There's zombie houses. I see zombie houses here in Eugene still to this day, even in a housing shortage. Even though we had the fires here where there's a housing shortage. So there's plenty of houses.
Yeah, absolutely. There's actually some estimates saying that there, for if at the pre-pandemic amount of unhoused people, that there is in the area of like, in some places, like in the Bay Area, they said there's 100,000 empty units, and they were saying that there was, you know, not even, I guess, the whole statewide, 50,000 people living outside is what they were saying. I, you know, this is probably not real, but but that's the numbers I use.
All right, so Keith McHenry, you also have, you've got a new book coming out, don't you? And you do paintings? Do the paintings
I'm an artist. And actually, when I started Food Not Bombs, I studied painting and sculpture at Boston University, and that's when I also became friends with Howard Zinn, who taught American history there. But yeah, and then I've written, first I wrote a book called Food Not Bombs, How to Feed the Hungry and Build Community. That was actually requested by New Society Press in came out in the fall of 92. And then was reprinted numerous times by C-Sharp Press in Tucson, Arizona. And then I came out with another book, Hungry for Peace, because, there was a lot of information from the first book was dated and so on. And then I rewrote the Anarchist Cookbook, after some correspondence with William Powell, who, compiled the first Anarchist Cookbook. And then I'm now working on what I'm currently calling the Food Terrorist Diaries. And it seems like that title is going to end up working out because of all the news about terrorism. And so that slogan, the Food Terrorist Diaries, I do have a chapter on the direct cause of that, of us being called food terrorists. And that would be the Mayor Buddy Dyer in Orlando, who had signed a release form for a young filmmaker that was doing a documentary about Food Not Bombs, and she was using the working title Food Terrorist, and then at a press conference he called us food terrorists, and right now there's a person who organized this campaign called Operation Orlando with Anonymous to block websites and so on and post things on tourism websites in Orlando, Florida. His name is Chris Dolan. He's in Commander X is how he's known, and he's currently he just got captured in Mexico and brought back to the U.S. and he's standing trial for a campaign he did of denial of service or of this county here in Santa Cruz for in protest to the attacks by the county of the unhoused. And so now there's a campaign, the hashtag Free Commander X. You can find all kinds of things out about that. So that's like super important that people get involved in that. So,
all right, yeah.
Keith
McHenry.
So that's where the term, and the book actually is not all about food, not bombs. It sucks. About a lot of different things during my life that then resulted in in the path towards becoming active with food, not bombs, and that kind of thing. So that's, some people might call it a memoir or something like that.
All right. So if you want to heal the planet, feed the poor. Is the
exactly.
Way to... All right. Keith McHenry.
Well, it's interesting. The World Food Organization, reports that at least half the food people are eating in the world is grown by women. And that, I think, is something important to acknowledge. And then one of the things that's very important to hold on to with about food is the memory of that farmers have about growing food in the lands where they live. And I had a project in Taos, New Mexico, teaching organic gardening as well as natural building and other survival techniques and so on. And I can tell you, growing food can be quite a difficult process. But at this point, the way the economy is and the political system is going, it's going to be very important for us to be able to grow our own food. That also means we need to be also preserving food through the periods of times when the season is not capable to provide enough food. That's a lot of work, and that's something that's probably one of the most important occupations in the world is a farmer. And it's a shame it's been so degraded and during my lifetime anyway, is something that people that aren't smart do, which is a real shame. So,
all right, Keith McHenry of Food Not Bombs, thank you for your great work and for your time.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me and your interest in Food Not Bombs. That's really cool. You have great questions. That's cool. Okay.
All right. Thanks, man.
Yep. Bye-bye.
And we will
turn you on.
If you're interested in local...